Okay, so today with me on the Loopcast, I have Paul Shari. He has written a report for CNAS called Robotics on the Battlefield Part 1, Range, Persistence, and Daring. It's a interesting paper, and it's a paper that examines the use of robotics on the battlefield and sort of the challenges of bringing more robotics to the battlefield and sort of the advantages and some of the disadvantages of using those robots, of deploying those robots. You could see Paul at the CNAS conference that's happening next week, Wednesday, June 11th. It's an all-day conference. I think Paul's talk is, I think, midday. I'm not sure. I think it's in the afternoon. I'd have to look at the
That's right.
schedule.
Yes, it's in the afternoon.
Oh, it's in the afternoon. So today we're going to be talking about the report, the state of robotics on the battlefield, and some of the sort of political and social impact and informational and sort of security impact that deploying robots on the battlefield has. I want to start off with Paul giving us a sort of sum of the field. What is the sort of current state and sort of use of robotics on the battlefield? And I know the popular image is the Raptor, flying above Afghanistan. Give us a more detailed picture of what does it look like? What is the current state of robotics on the battlefield?
Thanks for that introduction, and happy to be here. Yeah, I guess our report and our broader initiative, the 20YY Warfare Initiative that I'm leading at the Center for New American Security, is premised on the idea that some of the technologies that we're seeing today, with what are in many ways very technologically simple tools, like the Predator and Reaper unmanned aircraft, are just the beginning of what is likely to be a revolution in warfare. And when you look historically back, major changes in technologies in warfare, things like the introduction of the English longbow or the rifled musket or tanks and aircraft, have had dramatic changes in warfare. And countries that have been at the forefront of those, that have figured out the best ways to use those technologies, have stayed ahead. And countries that haven't have, in some cases, lost dramatically on the battlefield, lost their place in maybe the global stage. So we're very seized of some of these trends. A couple things sort of to frame how, thinking about robotics and how that plays into this. One of the things that's very interesting is right now the United States is certainly ahead compared to other countries in robotics, but that lead is fairly fragile. So when you look at the technology that's, say, behind Predators and Reapers, like I said, they're not very sophisticated. It's basically remote-controlled aircraft. There are 23 countries developing armed unmanned aircraft today. And realistically, simple armed unmanned aircraft will be within the reach of anyone who really wants one. If you're just an individual and you want to go buy an unmanned aircraft off the shelf and put explosives on it and use it like a flying IED to attack someone, you can probably make that happen. Now, fortunately, if you try to do that here in the United States, you're likely to draw the attention of the FBI. There was an individual who actually had a plot to attack the Pentagon a couple years ago with an unmanned aircraft. He was going to fly into the building. Probably wouldn't have done much to the building, but it certainly could have killed a number of folks, and the FBI had arrested him, and so thankfully that's not a problem. But the technology will be widely available to state and non-state actors and individuals. So this report is really about what are some of the trends in the technology, but more importantly, what might it do? What are the uses on the battlefield in an operational context? How might it change how people fight in warfare? Because when you look at the history of innovation in warfare, what it suggests is that who manages to come out on top in some of these major revolutions is not necessarily who comes up with the technology first or even the best technology, but who comes up with the best ways of using that technology.
Interesting. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, I think a lot of us, our awareness of robots on the battlefield is only through sort of the lens of the flying drones.
Right.
The UAVs. You've already mentioned the Predator, but the Global Hawk, and a whole family of them. But I mean, walk us through. I mean, what happens when we start applying this revolution to the Marine Corps or to the Navy, to the broader Navy or to the Army? What is, I mean, are we sort of, is the line we're sort of drawing saying that we're just, you know, we're going to move from flight into, you know, grounded drones, into more tanks and even sort of the naval aspect into boats?
Sure. So, you know, one of the analogies that people often have made in this area is that basically robotic systems, or and just sort of a bit on terminology here, when you think about what a robot is, it sort of has two features, right? It's unmanned. There's not a, it's a platform. Either it's an aircraft or a ground vehicle or undersea, but there's no person on it, and it has some level of autonomous functionality on its own. So I'll use some of those terms maybe interchangeably here. You know, they're slightly different concepts, robotic systems versus unmanned versus autonomous. Many of the things that we have today are unmanned systems, but they're largely remote controlled. But over time, they'll incorporate more autonomy and start to sort of creep their way towards what you think of as more of a robotic system. So I think when you think about some of the potential advantages, I just want to frame the threat environment first. What people have talked about is this idea that unmanned systems robotics are kind of at the level of where, say, the tank and the aircraft were at the end of World War I, where they'd been used in conflicts but in very niche roles. The aircraft, you know, aircraft were used in World War I, but largely for reconnaissance roles. They didn't have the same transformative effects they had in World War II, not yet. And same with tanks, they were used in roles but were not necessarily very decisive on the battlefield. And so after World War I and the interwar period, all of the major powers experimented with different concepts. And it was really Germany that kind of put it all together the right way in the Blitzkrieg, which was a combination of not just having the right technologies, tanks and aircraft and radios, but just putting them together in the concept of operations. So when we think about robotics, we're in a very similar place today where we've used them, the US has used them. In these very sort of niche roles, they're used for reconnaissance in the air. They're used for bomb disposal on the ground. So if you've seen the Hurt Locker, you've seen you kind of the role of robots there on the battlefield. And U.S. military has thousands of them. They're very useful in those contexts. And looking forward, they're starting to sort of creep into other roles as well. The military certainly, you know. In most places, people have wrapped their minds around the idea of using unmanned vehicles for reconnaissance and the value in that. The Navy just came out some information today. The Navy put down a contract for a Slocum Sea Glider. It's an undersea unmanned vehicle that can stay at sea for months or years at a time. The way it functions is it basically taps into thermal differences in temperature differences undersea to draw upon energy, and it glides through the ocean. It's a pretty neat technology. It's been around for a while, used in oceanography. Over time, unmanned systems will also probably come into combat roles. There are, in many cases, resistance for that to happen. So if you talk to the Army is all about having unmanned vehicles do logistics, to kind of move things, to do reconnaissance. When you start talking about using unmanned vehicles in a combat role, and I'm not talking about, you know, the robots themselves deciding who to shoot, a person's in the loop and controlling them, but using them for maneuver warfare, then people in the Army get a little more hesitant. Not necessarily that they are opposed to the concept, but it seems more more risky, more new, maybe more untested in some ways. Similarly, you know, the Air Force has certainly embraced the idea of unmanned aircraft for reconnaissance. But if you talk about the idea of using unmanned aircraft in like an air-to-air, air combat kind of role, a Top Gun kind of vision, that's heretical. I mean, that's just you're you know off the charts to kind of propose that kind of thing. And there was an article in Air and Space Power Journal in the last version where there was an Air Force officer proposing that concept, making an argument for an autonomous air-to-air fighter, and basically arguing, because of advantages in speed, if you build it and you do it right, there's no way a manned aircraft could possibly compete and win. But what's interesting is the person doing that was an unmanned aircraft pilot and instructor, not a manned fighter jock, if you will.
So maybe we should sort of expand on this. I mean, what do you see as common challenges that increased robotic deployment faces? I mean, you've already touched on the Air Force, but I mean, are these challenges really as institutional as you mentioned? Are there sort of deeper challenges that you've already mentioned, the sort of strategic challenge that, the idea that, maybe there's a lack of imagination or people aren't, they have the tools, but not necessarily the, how to organize them or how to put them together. But what are some other challenges, and what challenge do you see as sort of the biggest one, the sort of the one that's sort of holding back more deployment and sort of more integration of robotic systems?
Sure. So I think there's a range of them. Before I worked at the Center for New American Security, I spent the last 5 years at the Pentagon prior to this year working on unmanned systems in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And even within the Department of Defense, there's often confusion about why you would build an unmanned system. And so there are ideas out there like, hey, like this should save money. But quite frankly, the Pentagon is capable of making anything really expensive. And so then there are sometimes unmanned systems that end up being really costly. And people say, well, that didn't work. Or they'll look at Predator and Reaper operations and they'll say, there's all these people behind the aircraft operating it. And in fact, there are large numbers of people behind those aircraft supporting them. And for a couple of reasons. One, they're not really very autonomous at all. They're remotely piloted. So there's still a person behind them. The person's just doing it remotely. Because the aircraft can stay up for anywhere between maybe 18 to 24 hours at a time, depending on how much it's carrying, if you're keeping the aircraft up in the air continuously 24 hours a day, you need a lot of people to then operate it. You need pilots to fly it. You need sensor operators to operate the sensors on it. And then you're pulling a lot of data off the aircraft. I need people to process all that data. And that's where there's a huge manpower burden in processing all that data. For every single sort of 24/7 orbit is the term of art. So every sort of 24/7 spot on the globe where the Air Force keeps an unmanned aircraft, there are about 80 or so people just tied to managing the data coming off of that and processing it. And so that's extremely costly. And so people look at that and they say, well, how am I saving money? But that's not, you're not really comparing apples to oranges, right? So there's not a good analog in that case for a manned aircraft because we don't pull data like that and process the data off, say, an F-16. It doesn't really work that way. So I think that's one issue. And then sometimes it's just a lack of imagination about certain ways to use them. One of the really, really cool and interesting things that you can do with unmanned systems is you can make them cheap, and you can make them somewhat disposable or expendable. Or one term that's used is attritable. So you're not maybe making them absolutely expendable that you want them to be lost, but you're willing to take some risk. And if you take some attrition, that's okay. Well, that's a really new paradigm for the Department of Defense. We tend to generally build very costly weapon systems that are very survivable, and it becomes sort of this cycle where they become costly, so we have few numbers of them. So therefore, they need to be each one is more precious, and each one needs to be more survivable. And with unmanned systems, you could do something completely different. You can make them cheap, and you can buy tons of them. And if you lose them, it's not a big deal because there's no person at risk. But that's a whole new paradigm for the department, and so that can be challenging. So there's a lot of interesting, sort of issues there. There's this notion of swarming that I should be able to do something like what you see bees and ants do, where they cooperate and there's some sort of collective action that I could build a swarm of robotic vehicles. But no one really has figured out quite what that means yet. The part two of that report. The report that just came out is part one. Part two will look at swarming and the ability to deploy large numbers of cooperative networked autonomous systems on a battlefield and what that brings you. And that'll be out sometime in the fall. But that's really kind of a new idea. There's a sense that there's something there, but maybe there are some, you know, it's a new concept trying to figure out what exactly that means.
Interesting. So I want to sort of shift gears, and I think to sort of controversial ideas or sort of concepts that are sort of bring out the ire in people. And I think if you know, people in our audience that follow the drone debate will see this on Twitter, you know, drones sort of, it brings out a lot of negative imagery. So I think for the next part of the show, I want to sort of, you know, have us sort of discuss controversial topics. And I want to start off with something that plays a big role in your paper, or at least I thought it played a big role in the CNAS paper, was the concept of autonomy. You know, what I understood of it was the idea that you give a robot enough sort of, I'm going to use the analogy of a looseness on leash, you know, letting it go out into the field, deploying it on the field, and maybe only having a human being enter the loop once or twice. So, I mean, walk us through, you know, the concept of autonomy and sort of how this applies to you know, UAV usage and, you know, robotics at large.
Sure. Okay. So the what's tricky about thinking about this concept of autonomy is that we use the word autonomy to actually refer to different ideas, a couple different ideas. So the way I think about this is there's sort of three different aspects or dimensions of autonomy. The first is the relationship between the human and the machine. The second is the level of complexity in the machine. And then the third is what type of task or function the machine's actually carrying out. So when we talk about autonomy in terms of the human-machine relationship, we use words like semi-autonomous or human in the loop to refer to things where you might have a robot or some kind of autonomous functionality doing something, and then it stops and it waits for a person to take some action before continuing. We use words like supervised autonomy, and sometimes people refer to human on the loop to refer to some kind of machine that performs a task all on its own, and a human can observe and intervene if the person wants to change something or change what it's doing. And then sometimes people will talk about things being fully autonomous where the person can't intervene. Maybe there's not a communications link or something to that effect. So that's sort of one aspect of autonomy. What's really confusing sometimes is that we use the same word autonomy to refer to a totally different concept, which is the complexity of the machine. So we use words in everyday speak. We talk about things being automatic, things that are really simple. So an example in the military space might be a landmine. We wouldn't think of that as being autonomous. You would talk about it being an automatic thing or a tripwire. In your house, you would think of a toaster being automatic. When toasters were first invented, people called them robots. We wouldn't think of that today because it's not very complicated, obviously. And so another example might be in terms of thermostats, your old mechanical thermostat where you sort of set it to one temperature and then there's just a mechanical switch to turn on the heat or the air conditioning. Then we use words like automated to refer to systems that are a little bit more complicated, maybe like a Google driving car or a programmable thermostat where there's some more, a little bit more functionality in there. And then sometimes people will say, well, it's not autonomous unless it's learning or self-directed in some case. So there are, you know, some examples of that. There's a great YouTube video of a TED Talk by a guy named Hod Lipson, who's built a learning robot that taught itself how to walk, which is kind of interesting. In the thermostat space, again, there's the Nest Learning Thermostat that, you know, observes your behaviors and then learns kind of on its own. So that's a different concept than thinking about the human-machine relationship, right? You might have something that's very, very sophisticated, but it's still, you know, maybe there's still a person in the loop. It still stops at some point in time. They ask for permission to go forward and do something. And the third way is what is the task that's actually being performed by the machine? So both a landmine and a toaster are very simple, but what they're doing is quite different. And so that's really important when you think about, say, military systems. And sometimes, to be frank on this issue, when people look at autonomous weapons and get concerned about this idea that, they can look at something like a Predator, and then they look at the technology advancing in their household computer or their smartphone or, the car that has all the new fancy, I mean, I don't own one of these, but if you buy, say, the new, Mercedes S-Class, you got all the fancy, lane keeping and collision avoidance and all that good stuff. And they look at a Predator and they're like, oh my God, where is this going? And the DoD sometimes, I think, makes this problem a little bit harder than they need to, because they'll write these documents, these roadmap documents, and they'll say things like, we want to go to full autonomy. And people read this and they kind of freak out, because they're like, oh my God, like I saw that movie, it was called The Terminator, and it ended really badly, and they get scared. And it's a serious issue thinking about autonomy and the use of force and weapons, and I think there are serious concerns there. But sometimes, what the DoD really means is they just want to envision something that can get from point A to point B without getting lost or falling in a hole. So thinking about what the task is really, really important when you say autonomous. What are we talking about it doing on its own?
So I'm sort of then curious about this idea of the task. I mean, I understand, the legal complexity of something like surveillance, surveilling over Afghanistan or Pakistan might be a little less complex than, let's say, firing off a Hellfire missile. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, if you can sort of highlight the legal debate for us. I mean, it seems like if really these systems, for surveillance, you're letting them fly 24 to 36 hours at a time, and the human is only being introduced, up to the point where you fire off the missile. What is the legal debate surrounding this? And what is the role of responsibility? I mean, is it ultimately always human, the human in the loop that's responsible? Where do we incorporate the machine in the loop?
Sure. Those are great questions. And there was just a they're tough issues. And there was just actually a major conference at the United Nations Convention on Conventional Weapons in Geneva a couple weeks ago, where folks involved in the campaign to ban killer robots, a number of NGOs were there. I was there speaking. It was sort of an informal experts meeting that brought in a number of different people who understand robotics, the technology, as well as people involved in international law, looking at law of armed conflict. I think right off the bat, I just want to make clear that the things that exist today have like basically zero level of autonomy in this respect. So sometimes there's this perception that predators are flying around and hunting targets on their own, and there's some kind of algorithm involved, and then a person like decides whether or not to authorize a strike. That couldn't be further from the case. A predator is basically a remote-controlled aircraft with a camera on it. That's basically what it is. There are no algorithms on board that can identify targets or find targets. It's a person looking at a camera and a person making a call about whether to shoot a missile or not. So the main issue here is really focused on future technology and where things might go in the future. It's not clear that anyone's actually building these autonomous weapons right now, but the technology will be there, so it's certainly worth having these discussions now. The particular task that people have really focused on is the task of selecting particular targets to be engaged or to be attacked or blown up, if you will. So if you were to build something where a person says, this is the thing I want blown up, and then the vehicle or missile flies there and does that on its own, but the person chose the target. We have tons of things like that in the inventory of basically any major military today. They're called homing missiles or homing munitions or torpedoes or cruise missiles. They all function in that way where a person chooses the target and then launches this weapon that goes after the target. And those weapons have a high degree of autonomy because in many cases you're going after things that are, say, moving quickly in, three dimensions. If you launch an air-to-air homing missile, the person you're launching at is going to try to maneuver out of the way. and so the missile homes in itself. What's potentially different is this idea that you might have something in the future that's choosing its own targets and then making the decision to actually go engage them. There are a wide variety of views on this. It's not obvious that that's illegal. If you did it poorly, if you built something that was indiscriminately, attacking things and killing a bunch of civilians, that would clearly be illegal. But there's no particular law of war that says you couldn't build an autonomous weapon. There are technical concerns. There are concerns about strategic stability, policy concerns. There are certainly moral and ethical concerns that people have raised of, like, even if you could do this and you could do it safely, is that a moral thing to do, to not have people involved? And I think there are some really valid questions there that people are starting to figure out. But that's kind of where things are now. It's a really new issue, and people, I think, are starting to just kind of wrap their minds around it.
I want to sort of ask you a question. In InfoSec, we struggle with the idea of being able to explain very complex technical matters to people who are they're either technologists or privacy advocates or lawyers. And you try to explain that this certain piece of technology isn't as threatening or is threatening. Do you see that sort of same issue in robotics, the where you have scientists, you have technologists who are, way ahead of us all, who are just, developing state-of-the-art devices, and yet they have to sit here and sort of explain to legal professionals and to ethicists, why this isn't a danger or why this is a danger? I mean, is there that same sort of debate going on and sort of tension?
I would say that it is a challenge. I mean, I wouldn't think of it as a debate in the sense that there are, opposing sides in this context. Certainly, there are people campaigning on the issue of autonomous weapons, but I don't know that there's a, there are sides between, say, engineers and lawyers or ethicists. But there are people, with very different expertise and skill sets here. There are people that, are people that think about ethics and morality professionally. That's what they do. And those people tend not to be the same people that are engineers that build, robots. And they're the people that are professional lawyers. And so, like, dealing with a problem like this, or, any number of other emerging technologies, certainly lots of people are talking, thinking about cyber warfare. But take, for example, human performance enhancement. A lot of the technology is coming rapid. A lot of it exists today, with things like Ritalin and Adderall and Modafinil and Provigil and things like that. So, there are some of these issues, they raise concerns that require people to get together to bring together these different types of expertise. And you can't really have an informed discussion without understanding the technology. And that is tough. We spent a week in Geneva a couple weeks ago talking about autonomous weapons. No one's defined, I mean, that's not fair to say no one's defined the term. Different people have defined the term, but there is no agreed upon definition that everyone has bought into. And we got to the end, and I think people learned a lot and were educated, but there's still a healthy amount of confusion over what exactly we're talking about. So one person says, "I'm talking about an autonomous, a fully autonomous robot," and then somebody hears that and they envision the Terminator, and another person's envisioning a Roomba, right? And like that's really confusing. So I think it is difficult.
But I mean, you've touched on something very interesting, is that the marketing on the sort of, while I was doing research for the show, Ban the Killer Robots. I mean, it's very zazzy. It's very, very prone to being a meme very quickly, as opposed to, I mean, it almost seems like the other side of the debate is, drones are tools. You can put laws to tools. You can, this, it always seems like the negative side says ban the killer robots, and then the positive side comes up with, six paragraphs of explanation of why, drones are, tools or, robots, and it's the human element that, might put it to bad use. But I mean, in that sense, I mean, this image of the Terminator, I mean, is that doesn't really seem to be a very useful and very sort of constructive image to be attached to, robotics on the battlefield.
Yeah, I mean,
I
I
mean,
think you kind of took right out of my mouth what I would say. I mean, I think it's not, I think it's not helpful because I think it's really a distraction. And so the problem is when, you know, you say I want to ban killer robots, you know, people get this image from science fiction of these, you know, beady-eyed humanoid robots stalking through, you know, civilian areas shooting people. And that's not what people are, that's not what militaries, you know, I think would conceivably develop on any reasonable time frame. And yet there are very real things that are potentially not that far away with technology that essentially exists today that raise some of these troubling questions. And so, you know, when you say, like, well, I'm out against these killer robots, I think it kind of muddies the waters quite a bit. I think it's really not helpful. I think the issue is serious, and I think we need to discuss it. But a lot of the, from my perspective, a lot of the language, you know, maybe helps to draw attention to your cause, but I'm not sure it helps further a serious debate. That's my position, at least.
so I want to sort of shift our conversation over to the more infosec side of the debate. I mean, I think we've covered parts of the debate that have been sort of obvious and sort of people already are sort of talking about, but I'm sort of interested on the infosec side. And I want to start off with this idea of what is the sort of security model and the threat model you use for use of robotics on the battlefield. And what I mean by this is, how are we sort of thinking about or integrating the idea of software and hardware exploitation? You know, the idea that, you know, I'm loath to sort of use it, but hacking,
Right.
I think there's been examples of people sort of being able to get into the feed between the operator and the drone. I think this was in Iraq, but I'm sort of curious at a much higher level, at a strategic level, how are people sort of conceptualizing the danger of software and hardware exploitation being applied to robots?
Sure, no, that's a great question. Certainly. It's an area of a lot of concern. There was an interesting sort of you know, series of news stories back in December of last year where a hacker had hacked a Parrot AR drone and using that to with the Wi-Fi, like hacked into some other drones and then sort of took control of them. And so people were talking about zombie drones and being able to sort of take control of other people's drones and then, you know, do nefarious things with them. You know, cybersecurity, I guess what I'd say is basic cyber vulnerabilities exist in anything. You know, if a manned aircraft or ship or, you know, we get to the point where we've sort of digitized tanks and they become hacked and you can find a way to turn it off or reset it or disable it in some way, that's extremely disruptive. You do that to an airplane and, you know, it might fall out of the sky. So those basic vulnerabilities exist across the board. And certainly the U.S. military needs to make sure that its things are hardened from the ground up, which starts, you know, when it's first being designed, it starts with the fact that, you know, the people building this need to be building and designing these things on secure networks, because if someone gets in early and they steal your source code, that's not a position you want to be in. And there, of course, are similar issues with hardware, making sure that the supply chain is valid and reliable. Unmanned systems do introduce, you know, additional levels of vulnerability. In a couple different ways. For one, they rely on some combination of either your communications links or autonomy to function. So right now, something like a Predator relies, you know, really essentially on communications links in order to function. If it loses a link, it might fly to a point in space and circle until it runs out of gas. But it's not sophisticated enough to really carry out the mission. Though that's a design choice. It's actually a couple of years old. That functionality, you could certainly build things that would do, you know, fly pre-programmed waypoints autonomously. You could buy, you know, a drone off the shelf for a couple $100 that can fly GPS waypoints on its own. But that's a vulnerability, making sure that you have the autonomy that allows it to operate if your communications links are lost. But when it comes to the idea of someone hacking into something, one of the things that's interesting that changes is that, of course, you could actually take control of some kind of unmanned vehicle and then do something with it. It'd be hard to do that if there's a person on board who has physical access That if you tried to actually take it over, and fly the aircraft or steer the tank, the person could probably do something to prevent that. This also becomes an increasing problem with greater autonomy. So if you were to, hack into, say, the control feeds of a Predator today, not just to sort of see the video, but actually to control the aircraft, you'd have to like physically fly the aircraft because that's how it's flown. So you'd have to actually like input controls to actually move the rudder and the ailerons and all that good stuff. And even if you had an autonomous aircraft where you just say put in GPS waypoints, if there's a sort of a one-to-one control link, then you would need to control every single aircraft individually. So it'd be hard to sort of get a whole large number of them. Over time, when the technology moves to things like swarms, you've got a whole bunch of them. Maybe you've got 50 or 100 or 1,000 small unmanned vehicles cooperating together, and there's a single person overseeing the entire swarm. If you could get in and you can hack the entire swarm, one person could control quite a lot of military hardware. And so that's a challenge. It's a vulnerability. It's not unique to unmanned systems, but some of the things about unmanned systems exacerbate the consequences if someone were to actually be able to get in.
I mean, isn't that, I mean, from a standpoint of risk management, I mean, if you're sort of proposing that we're going to integrate more robotics, more software, more hardware into the battlefield, doesn't that produce a unique set of risks? Because, I mean, thinking about the evolution of a military, at least, at a very high up level, it seems, this might seem like a sort of joke, but I've never heard of somebody being able to hack an Abrams tank or an F-14 or an F-16, but hacking routers, robots, creating botnets seems really commonplace. And it almost seems, when I'm sort of making this argument of saying commonplace, I mean somebody like me, somebody with no military experience or could easily design this with no state resources, no billion-dollar army, but it seems like you're introducing a lot of risk to the force. Not you, but the idea of integrating a lot more robotics into the force. I mean, how do you sort of answer that critique that, the more software, the more hardware you put onto the battlefield, the higher risk of exploitation, the higher risk of hacking, of having somebody far off the battlefield sort of taking advantage of the situation.
Sure. No. I mean, I think all of not just the U.S. militaries, but other militaries' assets in the future will be connected to their military networks and will have digital functionality baked in. And so, hacking is a vulnerability for all of them. Yeah, you might not hack, an F-14 because it's an old style aircraft, but modern aircraft are going to have those digital vulnerabilities. Next generation tanks will have those, and that's something that we need to be building things that are cyber hardened from the ground up, whether there are people on board or not. So I think that's sort of something that across the board is a paradigm shift, and people understand the problem. And but one of the problems is that a commercially available technology is not really built that way. And to make things really hardened is costly, and it takes time to make sure that your supply chain, when you go back to the subcontractor, the subcontractor, the subcontractor is coming from assured sources, that is difficult and can be challenging. But I think people are certainly seized of it. When it comes to unmanned systems, I guess my view would be that one of the ways you deal with some of these risks is you have a diverse array of assets at your disposal. And not just, oh, you have some manned vehicles and aircraft and some unmanned ones, but you have a healthy mix even amongst all of those, that you don't have kind of like the all your eggs in one basket. You don't have the one widget that does everything for you. Because then if someone hacks it into it, or if there's a just a flaw in it, like we saw with the F-22's oxygen systems, where there was just a bug in the way it was functioning, and that was causing a problem for a period of time and it grounded the aircraft. Or if there just turns out to be a countermeasure that an adversary comes up with quickly. And in wartime environments, oftentimes the reaction cycle between innovations is very short, on a matter of months. And so diversity to me is really important. It's something that is interesting because it's sort of counter to a long trend in DoD thinking towards greater efficiencies. We're going to build, this one joint system that everybody does to get more efficiencies. If you have a whole bunch of different things, you've got different parts and you've got different software configurations and blah, 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 blah. And it's less efficient, but it's more robust to disruption.
Interesting. So I want to sort of maybe step back and sort of look at the idea of logistics. And what I mean is, it's not simply the movement of goods, but the movement of goods in a trusted network. That, how do you deal with, deploying complex technology onto a battlefield when sort of the components underlining that technology, as sort of you've already highlighted, require, one big company and then subcontractor within subcontractor within subcontractor. And sort of, I want to use the example of, sort of a commercially available drone, like a Parrot. If you think about it, if you go to their website and you sort of look at the people involved. So it's not just a software engineer, it's an embedded, designer. It's the guy who makes the plastic, who makes the frame. It's the guy who makes the PCB board. It's the guy who makes the Cortex, the A7 chip that runs in it. So, I mean, how do we create trust networks that are stable enough that we could sort of safely not only acquire, the components to make the robots, but also be able to deploy them faithfully on the field and, not have them be compromised or not have them be, have them do what we expect them to do.
Right. I think the building those sort of trusted supply chains is definitely very challenging because you have to really sort of build it from the ground up. And so much of this stuff comes from the commercial sector, where maybe you don't know, who those subcontractors are, or they're not built to those hardened specifications. And so, there's sort of a balance that's going to be required where some things the military is going to have to say. We're going to do this ourselves, and we're going to control where this comes from. We're going to build it to military specs, and we're going to make sure that it's hardened and it's super secure. But not everything can be that way because you don't want to miss out on some of the innovations that are happening in the commercial space, particularly in robotics or just information technology writ large, where things are moving at such a rapid clip. If you ignore all of that innovation and you say, well, I'm not gonna do that because it's not to military standards, then you might be really handicapping yourself. And somebody else who's willing to buy something off the shelf or buy pieces off the shelf and build something together might have quite an advantage. So I think it is challenging and it requires some balance. One of the ways that can help is to make sure that things are built in a modular fashion, with sort of open architecture design, so that you can swap things out. So if you have, you're building your fleet. Let's say you take commercially available drones to build out your fleet. It's not all the Parrot AR. You've got a mix of things, so that if somebody figures out how to hack into the Parrot, that your whole fleet's not compromised. And then maybe, you've got, your GoPro camera that you buy that you mount on that, and then maybe there's, other competitors to that that you also invest in. But you've set it up so that, you can swap all the pieces and parts among various systems, so that you can, take the camera or whatever sensors you have on any one given one and move them around. One of the things the military is trying to go towards is common control systems, so that, when you have a soldier on the battlefield, he or she doesn't have five different controllers for all the different air and ground robots they have. They have one controller that has, a common interface from a software perspective that other contractors that may be from a whole variety of different companies can build towards for their controls and then for their sensing data. And then that person, the soldier on the battlefield can take their one controller and they can use it with a whole bunch of different company systems, and it's seamless from their perspective.
So, I mean, let's address that then. How would we integrate private companies into this space? Because, so I'm just listing on my notepad here, who are the sort of largest producers of robotics in the United States, right? So you have Northrop Grumman, you maybe have Raytheon, and then you have I think Boston Dynamics is the other one, the one owned by Google. But then you sort of, you can even expand this list out and say, well, who's Alan Hamilton? You know, there's potentially maintenance contracts there, and you keep going out further and further and further, and it seems like the list gets longer and longer. So, in your mind, what should be the role and the responsibilities of the private sector when it comes to sort of deploying these systems on the battlefield?
Well, I mean, private sector companies are going to go where the profit is. And I think one of the things that's challenging for DoD is what comes attached to a government contractor is all sorts of other requirements and federal auditability and other things. And that can be really burdensome. If you're a major defense company, you've bought into that system, that's your business model, you've accepted that. But you look at a company like Google, they're not going to be interested in the defense sector. They bought Boston Dynamics, and they're going to do great things with it. But Boston Dynamics was doing largely military work, and Google's been very clear in saying, we'll complete those contracts, but then we're not going to pursue further military work. Because there's a combination of both the paperwork and the hassle that comes from dealing with the department, but also what I've heard from a number of companies is the profit margins really at the end of the day are not the same. This is particularly a challenge for small companies, that for them, some of these burdens in terms of the additional red tape is really cumbersome. And in addition, one of the challenges that DoD has is there's money for like sort of seed money for initial innovation. So if you're a startup doing something really cool with robotics or some other kind of technology, you can go to places like DARPA, you can go to places like the Office of Naval Research, ONR, and you can get money for these initial pilot projects. But those are kind of proof of concept demonstrations. And then if you want to translate that to like an actual, what the DoD calls a program of record, a funded program, there's debt in between them, where it's very hard to find funding to transition things. And so what a lot of companies do is they'll go to the military for that initial seed money, and then they'll take the technology that they further developed, and then they'll go and commercialize it, and they'll find a way to profit on that in the commercial space. Because the process for the DoD to build a program of record out takes years. There are lengthy processes inside the department. People build documents specifying the requirements for the system, what they want it to be. And if you're a small company, you probably can't afford to wait in order to see that maybe come to fruition. You need, cash flow much sooner. So that's something that we've heard from a number of companies. And I think it's interesting that it's a big challenge for the Department of Defense to come up with at least some opportunities where there are better paradigms so they can tap into that kind of innovation.
So I wanna, my last question, I think this is maybe the sharpest critique of using robots on the battlefield. And the critique goes a little like this. It's basically the rise of drones has paralleled the war on terror, that we fight not sophisticated enemies when it comes to the technology. So we go to Yemen, we go to Afghanistan, northern Pakistan, all sorts of places where the adversary doesn't have air defenses, doesn't have technology. I mean, you think about the Taliban, you think about your average sort of, Taliban fighter, and he's AK-47 and a radio. And I think the way that this critique goes is that drones are the product of this period from 2001 to, let's say, 2015. You know, help me sort of, address this critique. I mean, where do you see, at the, this is the tail end of our conversation, but, address the these critics that, have, are is robotics, here to stay, basically? And, how do you see robotics on the battlefield evolving with potential adversaries or evolving alongside, new adversaries?
Sure. So, I mean, I think robotic systems are certainly here to stay. I think that they will be very useful to a range of actors in a number of different types of situations because of things like their ability to take risk, their longer endurance, the fact that they can stay out in the battlefield for long periods of time, they can have greater range, greater persistence, because you can field large numbers of them. And if they're cooperating autonomously, you can maybe have better coordination and speed on the battlefield. I think all of those things will be game-changing, they'll be advantageous, and they will be relevant to, and they'll be available in the hands of states and non-state groups, and in some cases, even individuals. I think one of the, so I don't, I think the systems that we see today are a product of the types of conflicts the United States has been in, where we haven't needed things that were survivable up in the airspace. Everybody needed real threats to the airspace. So sometimes people look at unmanned systems and they say, well, they're not survivable, unmanned aircraft drones. Like, well, we haven't needed them to be. We built a certain type of one. We've used it because loitering up in the air to watch terrorists or insurgents and follow their networks and understand them has been extremely valuable. I think to the issue of criticisms about that technology, sort of the concern about drone strikes, I think in this case, I think people actually are confusing a technology with the use of the technology, and then particularly the policy of global counterterrorism operations outside of major combat areas against an enemy, in this case Al Qaeda, that doesn't have a country, they don't have a territory, they flock to places where there are ungoverned regions on the globe and places that are unstable where they can find safe havens and they can operate there. And my sense is that the people that are critical of U.S. Drone strikes, if you want to use that term, would be equally critical if the U.S. was using other tools to carry out those operations. If they were using manned attack helicopters or manned fighter aircraft or sending in teams of commandos, that they wouldn't like that either. And that the real issue is about the policy. And in particular, I really think that because there's no one raising concerns about the use of drones or unmanned aircraft in Afghanistan. They're used all the time to support operations that are to track insurgents. They're used to watch our troops and protect them and provide close air support and reconnaissance for them. And you don't hear people raising a fuss about that. And so that suggests to me that sometimes people maybe are conflating a policy issue with the technology, which I think is a little bit different.
Oh, interesting. So I think we've covered a lot today, but we always like to give before we end, we always like to give the guest the last word. So leave us with something to chew on before we head out for the day.
Sure. So, I think what's really been interesting to me looking at some of these issues and some of what are the potentials in unmanned systems is the role of culture and how militaries adopt any kind of new technology. And so there are lots of examples throughout military history. When the U.S. Navy first started to move from sail-powered ships to steam-powered ships, there was a lot of resistance inside the Navy. To people who didn't want to do that, they thought that steam power would make sailors lazy, and they wouldn't be as disciplined, and they wouldn't, that would be sort of was counter to their Navy culture at the time. There were folks inside the Army that resisted the transition from horses to tanks, in the interwar period from World War I to World War II. Now, fortunately, people who were advocates of tanks won out, but it's worth pointing out that the people who were horse advocates, weren't crazy. Horses had been used for thousands of years quite reliably on the battlefield. The tanks were new and they were unproven, and it didn't seem like maybe they would work, and there were all sorts of other challenges. The Army similarly had major resistance across the institutional Army to aircraft. And the Army went so far as to court-martial, quite infamously, early air power advocate Billy Mitchell at the time. And many of those divisions inside the Army led to the creation of the Air Force as a separate service. So, I think we see a lot of those things in unmanned vehicles today. We see them in the fact that how the Army and the Air Force operate some of their unmanned vehicles, their unmanned aircraft, which are very similar technologically, is very different. The Air Force uses officers, the Army uses enlisted personnel. The Air Force flies them remotely from the States, the Army forward deploys their people. The Army is embracing the ability for one person to control multiple aircraft at the same time. The Air Force doesn't like that. They're not moving forward with the technology. And there are some places where it's even more explicit. The Army has a policy, a written policy, prohibiting evacuating wounded soldiers with unmanned vehicles. It's a little bit crazy. It's an mission that's ripe for the use of unmanned vehicles because casualties are likely to occur in dangerous areas. You could build large numbers of unmanned vehicles that you could have forward on the battlefield to evacuate wounded very quickly. Getting them to a higher standard of care quickly is very important. There are some concerns there. There are issues with safety and continuity of care, but they're not insurmountable. NATO did a very comprehensive study on this and came solidly on the side against the Army's policy and said, you know, there's some potential here to save lives. But the Army has issued not one or two, but three memorandum over the last several years reiterating their policy prohibiting this, the most recent one just this spring in 2014. And that's all about culture. And so that's really interesting because that's the kind of thing where other countries may not have some of that same cultural reticence. And there's a risk. There's a risk that you miss out on a game-changing technology. And as a result, you fall behind. And the end effect of that is you might fight a war and you might lose. So the stakes are really high. It's hard to peer into the future and figure out what might be possible. But I think it's really imperative that we do our best to try to do so.
Of course. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Before we sign off, we'll post a link of Robotics on the Battlefield Part 1, Range, Persistence, and Daring. Thank you so much. That's Paul Shari. You can see him speak at the CNAS conference happening this Wednesday, June 11th, at the, I think it's the Willard Hotel. So we look forward to seeing you there. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for listening.